Afternoon, ladies, gentlemen, members on gavel to gavel. House Judiciary Committee has come to order. It's Wednesday, what is today, the 9th? 8th? One of those days. It's 1 o'clock, and present are Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Keller, Vice Chair Thompson, Representative Pruitt, and myself, Chair Gatto. First on the agenda today is House Bill 80. It's sponsored by Representative Newman, and it is labeled the Self-Defense Bill. That's the short name for it, but that's pretty adequate. A bit of housekeeping first. Cell phones and every other device that will make a noise should be silenced. Often thought, if something goes off, then you have to bring it up here and leave it on the table, because we can't trust you. But absent that, I'm sure everybody's got theirs turned off by now. I know I have mine turned off. So, with that said, Representative Newman, assisted by his capable aide, Representative Shattuck, is here. And so, I've called you Mark so many times, but I'll call you Representative Newman here. Please step forward, introduce yourself, affiliations, if any, and present HB 80.
Thank you, Chair Representative Carl Gatto, and members. Representative Newman, House District 15, the beautiful Susitna River Valley. Members, we've looked at this bill before. We kind of narrowed it down to, with the help of the Judiciary Committee last year, quite frankly, to just a one-line bill. And that's about as easy as we can get it, but that does not mean that we shouldn't have some good discussion on it. And that's an act relating to self-defense in any place where a person has a right to be. It has to deal with our Castle Doctrine. And our Castle Doctrine talks about how you have the right to use deadly force in your home or your place of business or where you maybe possibly rent. And you do have the right to use deadly force on those premises. This quite simply says that you have the right to use deadly force to defend yourself if you feel your life is at risk, if it's justified. Those justification qualifications still have to be fully met. We don't change that part of the statute. This simply adds one more line onto where it talks about the premises, again, in statutes 335, where that person owns or leases, and adds in there where you have any place the person has a right to be. So if you're out hunting, as you all like to do, and something happens, you should have that right to protect yourself where you're at. And I know when I talk to most Alaskans, they say, well, by golly, I would protect myself where we're at there. And that's what we're trying to clarify in statute, that perception or that thought that many Alaskans, including myself, have. And Mr. Chair, I do have Brian Judy from the NRA with me as somewhat of an expert testimony or expert on this matter. He's helped assist us in 16 other states and has assisted me on this. If I may ask him to come up, if there's any specific questions, he may be very well apt to answer them.
Sure. Mr. Judy, would you like to join Representative Newman? You're going to need a chair. No, we would prefer you didn't.
Well, if he is, it might be the other way around.
And for the record, in the audience, we have Department of Law, Rick Sabodny, and online, a member of the Alaska State Troopers that we've had in front of this committee a great many times, and that would be Lieutenant Rodney Dial. And, of course, just introduced Brian Judy here. So you've already made your – finished with your presentation? Mark, finished your presentation?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And, Brian, did you want to make a presentation? Please do.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Judy. I'm the Alaska State Liaison for the National Rifle Association, and I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 80. NRA views this as important self-defense legislation. that would provide that a person who is justified in using deadly force would not have to retreat from any place where the person has a legal right to be. And I want to emphasize that point, that the only people that this is going to impact are people who are justified in using deadly force. Under existing Alaska law, there already is no duty to retreat. Again, if a person is justified, if they're in their house, if they're on their property, if on premises they own or lease, in their place of business. So this would be the essential bottom line of this bill is that it would state that a person's life is as worthwhile or as worthy of protecting when they're any place to have a legal right to be as it is in these other locations. Again, that's assuming they are justified. So I want to take a minute and just run through what constitutes justification in the Alaska statutes. If a person reasonably believes that it's necessary for self-defense against what the person, again, reasonably believes to be unlawful force that would result in either death to the person or another person that might be protecting, serious bodily injury, sexual assault, kidnapping, or robbery. Only in those narrow circumstances is an individual justified in using deadly force. Now, the statute also goes through some circumstances where justification is not allowable. That includes if the person engages in mutual combat, if a person provokes another to try to get them to engage in a violent encounter, if the person is the initial aggressor, or if the person possesses a weapon in furtherance of a felonious activity, or in a gang-related activity. It doesn't say gang-related activity, but if you read the statute, it's pretty clear that that's what is intended. So if a person is engaged in any of these activities, they specifically do not have justification. So it's fairly specific. So then the question is retreat, and retreat is really the secondary consideration, because notwithstanding retreat, a person has to be justified per the Alaska statutes. So basically what this bill does is it removes one additional question that a person in a life or death decision-making moment has to make. You know, they already have to go through this whole thought process regarding whether or not they're justified. We're just removing the additional question they have to answer in their mind: can I safely retreat? Again, they don't have to retreat in any of these other locations, and this would just expand that to any place they have a legal right to be.
Let me ask you a question before you continue. Let's just say you are person A and you come upon a crime being committed, person B against person C, where it's lopsided, and you decide that deadly force is required. Since it's not you that is subject to threat, how would that be treated as far as duty to retreat?
Mr. Chairman, the statutes do provide that a person is justified in protecting his or her life or the life of another. So if the person went through that thought process and determined that person C was facing death, serious bodily injury, kidnapping, sexual assault, robbery, then technically they under the provisions of this proposed bill, they would be able to defend that person.
And I think we see this sometimes in some person A beating up person B mercilessly, and you know, if you go in there and say stop that, you will probably become the second victim. So at that point, what are the options to a person who is living under House Bill 80?
Well, Mr. Chairman, obviously the first option is to take out the cell phone and call 911, and I would think that the majority of people would do that. But then, you know, again, yeah, and I'll tell you, my experience And I handle a lot of states, and I talk to a lot of people, about concealed weapon permits. And what I've found is that generally people with concealed weapon permits, people who are carrying a means of self-protection with them, they tend to avoid confrontation because it's generally understood that whether you're a good guy, whether you're a bad guy, if you pull the trigger in an encounter, a self-defense encounter, you're probably going to be arrested. And I found that most people who take the responsibility on themselves to carry a means of self-protection understand that, and they're going to do everything they can to avoid confrontation. And I talked to people who saw a scenario like you were describing, and they specifically laughed and called 911 because they didn't want to end up getting arrested. So that's the first option. The second option, if it's a person who truly believes that they have justification, they've gone through this analysis, then they could intervene.
Representative Newman, your thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then again, in justification statutes in 330, it talks about, as Mr. Brady had previously mentioned, in mutual combat. And if I was to enter into a combat situation, I would suspect that might be a mutual combat situation where you're entering, you know you're voluntarily entering into a situation that could be dangerous to yourself. This is not about mutual contact. This combat is about your own personal self-defense if you are being attacked.
Good. Thank you. Brian, go ahead again. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Gruenberg, question?
Mr. Trudy, I don't know. I'm glad to see you. I have some general questions. I don't know if you're going to talk about the statute generally. Are you still making your presentation, or are you finished?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I had just a couple more
points. I'll wait until you're finished. Thank you.
Just to finish up, essentially under existing law, a person who resists an aggressor bears the risk of a finding that although their reaction, their use of force was justified and was proportional to the reasonably perceived threat, that they still risk a finding that they overestimated the difficulty of retreating. And thus, even though they were justified because of one of those factors that I discussed, they could be found that they should have retreated. And that's the view of the NRA, is that a person who is justified, who goes through all those, all those parameters and is truly justified in that split second life or death decision making moment, they should not have to then say, okay, well, I'm justified now. Let me think. Can I retreat? Because obviously the jury is going to be considering, the whole situation in the sterile situation of a courtroom. And I would suggest that out there on the street where the adrenaline's flowing and a person has a split second, it's just one additional thought process that should not have to be gone through. So the bottom line is that it's our view that victims should have the protection of law, not criminals. Without repeating myself, it's just it seems like a very logical, very narrow bill, and the NRA urges your support.
Okay. And for the record, we were joined earlier by Representative Holmes, who now has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Newman and Mr. Judy. I agree with a whole lot of what you just said, both of you. Absolutely. If you're in danger, you should absolutely have the right to defend yourself. I 100% agree with that. I guess my question is, don't we basically, we heard of a similar bill a year or two ago, so we've had a lot of time to kind of flesh some of these out. And it just seems like most of the examples I hear from people of times when they would want, when they feel they ought to have the right to defend themselves and want this bill to cover them, they're actually already covered by our current statutes, which in my understanding are actually some of the most protective of individual rights of any in the country. I mean, we're a gun state, and we definitely I'm 100% okay with that. But right now, the law, as I read it, says that in order for you to be in trouble for defending yourself, you had to have actually known, and I'm using the words right out of the statute, you have to know that you can retreat with complete personal safety and complete safety as to others being defended. So the whole idea that I get the fight or flight instinct, that's adrenaline's rushing, you're in danger, you need to make a snap decision. And maybe you could have retreated with complete safety, but you weren't sure, and you went ahead and acted. I would say you didn't know that you could do that with complete safety. And I guess my question is, aren't we already pretty well protected under the statute as it is? And who's being prosecuted out there that shouldn't be? Because I don't want people prosecuted who are really defending themselves. Absolutely not. I have no interest in that. I want people to be able to defend themselves and defend their loved ones and defend the general public. But who's being prosecuted out there that shouldn't be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holmes, you're right. The current statute is very good. And this would just take it the rest of the way. There are 16 states that currently have this in the statute. And it would just go a little bit further just to ensure that a person has that ability to act on justification. And you know, I know that there was one incident at a church a couple years ago, and you know that was a somewhat controversial case, but you know the individual was ultimately acquitted, and that's the whole point of this. The whole point of the statute is to try to prevent people who are justified and who did make a split second decision, hopefully the right decision. Don't have to go through the angst of a criminal proceeding and the cost of hiring an attorney to defend themselves. You know, just to hope that if there's justification, basically this nothing more than shifts the burden slightly. It shifts the burden of risk from the potential victim to the aggressor, because now the aggressor's going to know that the person doesn't have to make the calculation as to you know whether or not there's you know they can retreat with safety. And you know I would suggest that this makes the job of a criminal just a little bit riskier.
Follow up. And my concern, I guess my concern is that we not make it easier for the criminals to get off, the bad guys. And I guess my concern is we have this very pretty well written statute on the books in front of us, and I guess my area of concern, since we actually, you know, we can come up with one case of somebody who did have to go through a trial, was actually acquitted. You know, there aren't a whole lot of people going to trial in this state who are defending themselves. I'm happy to be proven. I wouldn't be happy to be proven wrong. I'm willing to be proven wrong, Representative Newman, if there are a bunch of people going to trial who were really defending themselves. What I want to make sure in my interest in having the fleshed out discussion on this bill is that we not make it easier for criminals to get acquitted. And I know that is your goal, both of yours as well. You don't want to see criminals walking. You want to see people who are legitimately defending. I think we have the same goals here. I think it's just a question of how do we make sure that the people who are defending themselves you know, aren't harassed and get to go home at the end of the day, and how do we make sure the people who are criminals go to jail.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holmes, I don't know what kind of opposition there's going to be today. I know that there was, I mean, this bill was, you know, pretty significantly fleshed out last year, I guess it was. And I know that there were a lot of scenarios that were brought up. At the time, Department of Law had a document they were circulating with a number of scenarios. And you know, they refer to those scenarios as similar to real life cases they had. Now, I don't know what the differences were, but I know that in every one of those cases there were prosecutions. So I know that in all those cases the person wasn't justified, and I think that's the important point, is that that a person has to be justified, and you can go through 1181, I think it's 330 and 1181, 330 and 335, I believe, and I've glossed over it, but it provides very specific parameters under which a person is justified, and it also lists these specific circumstances under which a person cannot claim a justification. And I think most of the scenarios, most of the cases where there are criminals, and you're right, we don't want to protect criminals, but I think that the majority of the cases are, you know, they're either not going to rise to the level of justification, or they're going to fall into the circumstances that specifically don't warrant justification.
Representative Newman. Chair and Representative Holmes, if I may, through the chair, my understanding of your question was basically why and who. You know, you read a part of the sentence that talks about justification. And following on to that, it says a person can avoid, if you know that with complete safety, that person can avoid the necessary use of deadly force by leaving the area of encounter, except there is no duty to retreat if the person is in your home, in your place of residence. We are simply adding where you have a legal right to be. So we want to clarify that so that the people who are having to spend their life savings to protect themselves from the criminals who continue to gain seemingly more rights than the victims, so that we can protect those victims, you know, who have to go out and spend their life savings, borrow against everything they've got, so they can protect themselves against a system we've heard previously where typically everybody gets arrested, and then we'll sort it out. You know, there's ways that a person can be made to stay in their home and stuff, but we want to make sure that those victims' rights are protected before something happens. Current statutes also talk that you do have the right to use deadly force if you are being raped, if you are being beaten up. What about protecting yourself before that happens? You know, do we need a court system that says, well, you know, we're going to question this, whether you had that right to retreat? That person as the being a victim at that time is a person who has to make that decision under those split-second moments, whether their life is in danger. That's who we're trying to protect here.
Okay. Let me just take a little aside here. In the back of the room, Betty Bear, would you stand up, please? Betty brought some students with her who are interested in watching legislative process. If you'd like to introduce them, would you do that?
I would be honored to. Jessica Lucan from Anchorage, and they're all close up, IDA close up. And Jerry Warren from Missoula, and Jimmy Moynaugh from Missoula.
Thank you. And close-up students are... The word describes it all, doesn't it? Yeah, we don't want to learn about it from 600 miles away. We want to be in the room. Okay, thank you. And Representative Newman, the words knows with complete safety. It's only four words. Knows is an absolute, and complete is an absolute. These are hurdles that no one can reach. So if somebody said, well, you knew that you could escape with complete safety, will never occur, ever. And so that's the difficulty I have when we read knows with complete safety, that a person needs better protection than that because it will never happen. So with that in mind, if they had written it suspects with reasonable safety, it would be a wholly different clause. But the hurdle is pretty high. So did you have additional? Hold on a second. Did you have further comments before I interrupted you to talk to our person in the back? No? Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For those folks who haven't heard the bill before, and even for those of us who have, this issue of self-defense has, and still does, consume a lot of time in first-year criminal law classes, as those of us who practice law for fun and profit know. And what I'll do is try to get to the members a copy of the chapter on Perkins on criminal law and self-defense, and talks about the Castle Rule and stuff like this. But this statute, the way it's written, requires that the person, that there must be a necessity to use deadly defense. That's a very high standard. It's not just a reasonable belief or a probability or a possibility. There has to be absolutely a necessity through the chair. Isn't that right, Mr. Judy, under the wording of the statute?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broomberg, yes. In fact, the language basically says if the person reasonably believes it is necessary for self-defense against what the person reasonably believes to be unlawful use of force. So, yes.
And does the term, let me just interrupt, does the term reasonably believes trump the word necessity?
Mr. Chairman, I think they go together. The person has to reasonably believe that it's necessary.
I don't see the word reasonably. If may not use deadly force if the person knows that with complete safety and with complete safety as to others, the person can avoid the necessity. It doesn't talk about reasonably believes.
Mr. Chair, if I'm
Chairman, we're looking at subsection
A. The beginning of 335 before going down.
Oh, it's a different statute. Oh, okay.
Can you repeat that, Mark?
The beginning of statute, section 335, to which this is applicable, the fourth sentence down talks about the person who reasonably believe, and I believe your statute went in that direction.
And Representative Holmes had a comment.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to say it might be helpful if we could get a copy of all of 1181.335.
Yeah.
I'm reading, so that's why I've got it right here. I think Mr. Judy's reading off subsection A, and we only have subsection B in our packet, and they go together. So if it would be possible to get a photocopy of the full statute.
She's doing that.
I think that's where we're getting caught up. We're reading different sections of the statute.
And in fact,
who?
Jane.
Oh, okay. A lot of women here. I don't know who they are. Representative Gruenberg, please go ahead.
I didn't realize that. But I'm going to pass on. This
don't
is.
That's not the right words to use on this bill.
Wrong word.
These guys are really sharp. Yes.
Throw the sugar.
When we listened to the bill last time, and Representative Newman and I had a good conversation later in his office, it was my thought that the way this statute is written, particularly with the proposed amendment, we might want to look at other aspects of the statute, because it seems to me that in any place where a person has a right to be would probably include when you're as a guest or express or implied agent of the owner, blah, 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 there you'd have a reasonable right to be there. You might not always have a reasonable right to be. I'm looking at sub A on line 9. If you own or lease the premises, because a landlord can't go into the apartment without giving the tenant 24 hours notice under the Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act. So you might not have a duty to be there. And where the person resides, you might not have a right to be there if you're the subject of a domestic violence order or something like that. But some of these others you might not need to keep in if we pass this. And similarly, Mr. Chair, lines 15 and line 1 on the next page, in a building where the person works in the ordinary course of the person's employment. However, you might not have a right to be in somebody else's office in the Empire State Building. You might have a right to be in the building, but not to the area where the altercation occurred. So that is probably not congruent either, but certainly it seems to me as a guest or implied agent, I'm not sure, but that might always apply.
Well, Attorney Gruenberg, let me ask you this question. If a person is not prohibited from being somewhere, does that imply they have a right to be there?
Well,
or
that's
certainly allowed to be there.
That's kind of a tautology. Let me explain. If I'm not prohibited from coming into your home, in a practical sense, as a legally, though, I'm not able to be there unless you invite me in. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of a complicated question. I'd have to really think of the fact. But the other thing that I'm concerned about, that I think that this may be too narrow the way it's written, and that's subsection 4 at the top of page 2. Protecting a child or a member of the person's household, you could have a real reason to protect somebody else. your mother or a disabled adult or somebody you're with. And the question I think we should legitimately look at, should there be an ability to use deadly force to protect those other people, at least in certain circumstances? And I think probably there should. Through the chair to either of the witnesses.
Member of the person's household.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunberg, as you've stated out, you know, there's other statutes that apply to law in this. This is your own personal self-defense, first off. But, you know, you're right. Probably if a person wanted to get rid of possibly one and three and just leave five as a friendly amendment, maybe we could go that way. But we're trying to stay as simple as we can. I'm kind of a kiss guy myself when it comes to that.
Through the chair, I was actually more concerned about four being too narrow, because I think in this day and age where we have extended families and grandparents and grandchildren, you could have custody of a grandchild, and technically that's not it. Well, it could be still, but you see what I'm saying. I'm just concerned. At some point, we may want to look at that wording, because I want to be able to protect those kinds of people, too.
Well, now, it generated a question from me. A member of a person's household, as a great many people consider their pet a member of the household.
They're not persons, though.
It says a member of the person's household, a member.
That means people. We can check with the lawyers, but I would interpret that as being a person, mm-hmm. because legally a pet is property.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. It's like, except there was a state Supreme Court case on the subject of any dialogue with you that talked about custody of a pet, but it's traditionally been property. And I see my wife is in the audience. We've had lots of discussion on exactly that point, and I think quite clearly that intended the word member was a human.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Good question.
As some additional information is being passed out, we'll just briefly pause here. Okay, the light's on. We're back on the record.
Mr. Chair, corrections staff, my chief of staff, is copying section 340, which deals with defense of a third person, and that will be passed out. I wasn't aware of that, and that covers the other members.
It's here.
Yeah, okay, Rex has got that up. But the other thing I wanted to mention in this Hornbrook, Perkins on Criminal Law, which at least when I went to law school 40 years ago, was the main text. They talk about the Castle Rule, and this is page 1009 of Perkins. A substantial minority of jurisdictions has adopted the so-called retreat rule, Susan? Which we have here. While the application has been considerably whittled away by exceptions, the underlying position can be stated in a summary of the stand taken by Beale. That's B-E-A-L-E, and Beale who wrote Retreat from a Murderous Assault, 16 Harvard Law Review, 567, 1903. Quote, an innocent victim of a murderous assault must elect an obviously safe retreat, if available, rather than resort to deadly force unless, one, he is in his, quote, within a quote, castle, unquote, within a quote, at the time, or his assailant is, two, one he is lawfully attempting to arrest, or three, a robber, end of quote, footnotes omitted. So that's a term of art in this law of self-defense.
So they put castle in quotes.
That's right.
Quotes inside of quotes.
That's right. And that.
So castle is defined?
Well, there's a footnote. And the footnote cites a 1944 case, State v. Robinson from Delaware, a 1952 case, Commonwealth v. Fraser from Pennsylvania, and a West Virginia 1935 case, State v. Priest. I got to tell you, this is an ancient book, because I graduated 40 years ago. So they probably have updated it since then. But it's obviously of some...
Well, it's valuable and to at least know what the original thinking was.
Yeah.
All right. Nothing, Representative Holmes?
I I think I'm good for the moment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Newman?
No, Mr. Chair, only to say that Representative Gruenberg and his Knights of the Shining Armor or Roundtable are doing well. But I also would say that Representative Holmes told me one time if you ask three lawyers a question, you'll get at least four or five answers. So. Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Representative Newman, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I like it. I just turned in a slip to be a co-sponsor on it. Thank you.
Any other committee input that we want to make here?
May I just inquire for a second, please?
Certainly.
Gretchen, were you copying Section 340?
Yeah, we have it.
Yes.
Oh, you got it.
In your packet.
It's in the packet. Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Okay.
Do we have public testimony there, Sarah?
I only have a short list here. Let me ask, Doug Moody, are you online?
That's on House Bill E.
Yes, Chair, I am online.
Okay. You had asked to speak yesterday, and it was my fault that I closed the committee down and forgot that you were wanting to speak. So can you speak now?
Yes, Chair, I can.
Thank you. Do you have testimony or just want to be available for... Oh, I'm sorry. Did I pick the wrong one? Oh, yeah, I did. I picked the wrong one. I'm sorry. Yeah, we didn't handle 80 yesterday. We will get to 127. Hang in there, and it won't be long.
Mr. Chairman, I'm available if anybody has questions for the public defender on this one.
Okay. Public defender questions from anyone on the committee?
Yeah, I do.
Go ahead.
Mr. Moody?
Correct.
Mr. Doug Moody. Mr. Moody, this is Max Gruenberg. Do you have any comments on the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the only comments we'd have is if you, with the addition of this line or this sentence to the bill, it removes... let me back up a second, rephrase that. The problem with a person that's out and just out and about in public, I believe Brian Judy was talking about hunting earlier. If you're out hunting and you get confronted by somebody in an altercation and you have a duty to retreat because you're not in your own home, you're not in your business, the issue becomes, at what point during that altercation do you make that decision? And what this amendment does is says you're not going to be held liable if the jury decides that you should have made it 2 seconds earlier. Because you're under the press of the situation and you've got to say, well, he's screaming at me. Does this mean I have to turn and walk away now? Even though I've got a perfect right to be here, so you've got that issue, and there was some talk about from some of the members of the committee about the high burden of nose with complete safety, but that becomes a jury question, and the. It gets submitted to the jury, and the jury will decide whether you knew it or not. They can infer from conduct whether you knew it or not. With this amendment, the focus becomes on whether, under the circumstances, you're justified in defending yourself in a situation that you didn't make or bring about, rather than the focus, an initial focus being on, did I wait too long to leave because I thought I had a right to be here? And that's our only comment on that, on House Bill 80.
Well, let me follow up just a little bit about, you know, it's theoretical picture, but it's the picture that came to mind. You're out hunting, and you run into another hunter. And the hunter says, this is my territory. Get out of here. And you say, I have a right to be here, and here's the key. And he says, I'll give you till the count of three. You better be gone by the time I say three. Now, what is the scenario with regards to self-defense?
Through the chair, that could be viewed different ways in that situation. A jury could conclude that you had a duty to retreat at that point, and you should have turned around and walked the minute he won. A jury could conclude that once they said, this is my territory, you leave, you've got a duty to walk away. Because you knew that he's armed, you're armed, that could result in a shooting. So you just have to leave and walk away. Jury could conclude that when he says, you leave by the count of three, you've got a duty to walk away at that point, because he's escalating it, but you still have a chance to go away. A jury could also very easily conclude, based on those facts, that he says, you have to leave by the time of count of three, you don't leave, he starts raising his gun, you shoot, that you're okay. Because you didn't create the situation. This guy was the one that was aggressive. You had a right to be there, etc. And the jury is just sympathetic with your being there. And the question is, or the problem is, you don't know where the jury is going to come out. And it could come out three different ways. And I think with the addition of this language, what it does is it changes the focus on the situation, whether you were provoking the situation or engaged in misconduct, if you will, or whether somebody else is forcing you into a situation where you have to defend yourself.
Well, you're the public defender. I want you to defend me. I don't trust a guy that says, I'll give you three to get out of here. I'm certainly not going to turn around and walk with my back to him. I don't want to walk backwards through the woods, and I don't want to leave. So, am I the one in the most trouble here? He actually made a threat, and I didn't. Isn't a threat sufficient evidence that my life was in danger, and I've decided to shoot him in the kneecap, and I miss and I get him in the heart? All those...
Mr. Chairman, that's what I would be arguing. I would be arguing that you were put in a situation by somebody that was being unreasonably aggressive, and that your only action that guaranteed you safety was to shoot first in this instance. But I would have to, as your legal advisor, I would have to tell you that it comes down to a jury call. You get 12 people on the jury, they may not see it your way. And if the state offered you a plea bargain to plead to some lesser charge or whatever, I have to say you have to consider your options. I'll advise you, and I will take you to trial. I think, you know, depending on where we are in the state, you might have a better argument in front of a jury than in other locations, but I'd have to advise you, you know, we'll go for it, but it's your decision, and it is risky.
Okay.
Because it is a jury question.
And I think that's the reason why Representative Newman has the bill in front of us, is that we want to tighten up for the person who is literally becoming in jeopardy from people who have no right to place them in jeopardy by saying, listen, I have a right to be here. And when you take an action based on your right to be somewhere, you have a greater defense, a greater measure of credibility, and that is essentially, I believe, the crux of the legislation. Anyone else? Oh, by the way, thank you, Mr. Moody, for speaking. Other members have questions for the public defender or for anyone else? Okay, I don't have, I'm surprised, I don't...
Chairman, do we have anybody else online?
That's what I'm just about to ask. and looking at our person in the back, there's no one who called in wanted to testify online. So I'm kind of reluctant to close public testimony at this part. I think there may be some people that do want to call in, and so I'm not going to close public testimony at this point. Representative Gruenberg?
Are we going to hear from the Department of Law?
We could, yeah. Mr. Svodny, did you want to speak to this?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
See,
I will have a question. Yep.
Okay, well, come on up then.
It's a one-word question. Speak.
That's not a question. That's a command.
Will you speak?
Speak? Will you speak? That's a
question.
You're in the barrel, sir. Go ahead and take a seat. You have... I need you to introduce yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Svodny. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
And you have heard us go back and forth with a conversation here about the bill. And you have big, big, thick books in front of you that have notation marks in them. So there's probably something that you would like to add to whatever you've heard here.
Actually, I don't want, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I want to deal with any of the hypotheticals that you've been throwing out, but I'm happy to add any questions. My bookmark is for the actual statute. You guys have obviously already figured out that there's three or four statutes that this particular bill pertains to. And I guess I would just mention for Representative Gruenberg, and I think that's cleared up. There's an entire separate section of Alaska statutes, 1181.340, I think, in defense of other people who aren't your children or members of your household. So what that provision is in there for is you don't have an obligation to remove yourself from a situation where you're using self-defense and it's your child or a member of the household. That's only dealing with an obligation to remove yourself from the area.
May I follow up on that?
Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you. I'm just going to ask, if I may ask a couple of questions, please.
I'll start with the first one.
Okay. I find this statute, this whole thing, very confusing. Maybe everybody else really understands it, but I find it has double negatives and all kinds of things. What is the general rule about retreating?
How much do you want to know? I spent the morning actually looking through the minutes of the Criminal Code Revision Commission about it. I can go back that far, or actually, the cases that deal with the duty to retreat in Alaska were pre-territorial. They were in the 30s and 1935. And the Ninth Circuit indicated that there was not in the territory of the state of Alaska an obligation to retreat. In 1978, with the revision of the criminal code, the legislature made a determination that under some circumstances, not under all, but under some circumstances, if you could remove yourself from a situation of danger in complete safety to yourself or others, then you would be required to do that. You didn't get a free shot, so to speak.
And they use the word complete safety?
I think it does say complete safety. Mr. Chairman, this, and I'll look here as I'm speaking, this becomes a little bit more complicated because actually 1930, 1935, 1978, and then 2006, there was a revision of this particular section with Senate Bill 200. And so they may have changed the language in that. Whoops, sorry. Wrong bill. I had the 2006. Complete safety.
And does that mean 100%?
That's really
the crux of it for me and for several other members here. We make a bar that we can't reach.
You do not need to retreat unless you can do that in complete safety. That is, unless there's no danger whatsoever to you. In your example, the 1-2-3 example, you didn't have a duty to retreat because you just explained, I don't want to turn my back on this guy. So, it's somewhat difficult to answer your question because self-defense is not an affirmative defense. It's not one that the person who's charged with the crime and who's raised this defense has to prove. It is that the state has to prove all of the negatives. Was the person reasonable? Would in his or her belief, would society say this is reasonable in their belief? The state has to, prove the negative that that under these circumstances there might not have been some danger to the person. All those are things that the state has to prove. So when you say that the person in your example, that the person who turns their back would have to prove that they could in complete safety, is really the other way around. The state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no way that you could retreat, or there was no danger to you in retreating.
Okay. And I know it's an aside, but you're 60 years old, you own your own house, you don't have a car payment, you've got money in the bank, you've got kids in college, and you have to make a decision on risking all of that in a moment, because the way the court sometimes decide. That's a very difficult, another difficult issue. And you got to do all of this, protect yourself, complete safety, don't risk my family's welfare in a moment. And how can you be so sure you'll be right every time when you're not practiced, like police officers may be? So I hope the courts are a little generous, a little more generous, and I think that's why we have this legislation in front of us, to give the courts a real hook to put themselves hanging on that says, hey, this is what it says. He had a right to be there. And that is not something that's going to be difficult to interpret. So I thank you for your testimony. Question from Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're from the Department of Law, and I was wondering on the fiscal note, for some reason you've got a $450,000 addition to the budget. I would think that this would reduce your budget, not increase it. I mean, you're not going to prosecute as many people. There's a lot of things involved that I am really surprised that this isn't a minus 450 instead of a plus. Can you explain that?
Certainly through the chair. Actually, that's consistent with fiscal note from last year and years before. Here's the issue. Somebody's dead. Somebody's been hurt, beat to death with a club, or stabbed, or shot. Those cases have to be reviewed and decisions made about them. The number of one of the law review articles that related to the change in 2006 quoted a pretty well-known Anchorage defense lawyer as saying, hooray, when can it get signed? These cases, the likelihood of litigation will probably increase over a lot of these questions. And so there was 1,100 cases that potentially self-defense was an issue. Those will at least need to be reviewed. And if you take, 25 to a quarter of that, that's basically where they'll turn out to be self-defense. That's two prosecutors.
Follow up.
Yes, please. So you had 1,100 in some cases last year, that 1,155 cases in 2010 in which self-defense was a potential justification. Are you saying that this is going to increase the number of self-defense cases? I mean, I would think that some of these would not be followed up on if this passes. So why are we going to have an increase?
Through the chair, they still need to be reviewed to make that determination.
You're already reviewing them, 1,155. You're going to have more cases to review or less?
Well, we're going to be reviewing the same number of cases, but the likelihood of well, you heard from Mr. Moody, you know, he's going to want to try more of them.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions, but first, following up on Representative Thompson's point, I kind of had the first same initial thought, which was, really, I would think there'd be less. But I think that we're thinking of something different than the Department of Law is thinking about. I think we're thinking about what you and I and most people in this room think of as self-defense cases. You know, I think what the Department of Law may be thinking about is all of the what are really murders out there where people say, it was self-defense. It wasn't what you or I would think of as self-defense, but if they claim self-defense, the Department of Law still has to go out, like you said, and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't. And if we make a change to the self-defense statute, which makes it broader, it makes it easier for the bad guys to claim self-defense, and it makes it harder for the prosecutors to claim that it was really murder in the cases of what you and I would really think of as murder. I would assume that that would be part of it would just be that much harder for prosecutors to prove that criminals did not, or that it wasn't actually self-defense.
Through the chair, that's exactly correct. If there's true self-defense, we ought to be screening those cases. We're screening those cases out now. I know that, you know, that you heard that there was one case years ago where two people were shot in the back, and the state didn't believe that was self-defense, so we took that to trial. But you have it exactly correct. I mean, we agree with the sponsor. I mean that we want to protect the victims of crimes, and if somebody is using self-defense, they're true self-defense. They're a victim of a crime. And let me give you Mr. Judy suggested that the cases from the letter last year weren't true. They actually, four out of the five went to the appellate courts. We prevailed on those. They were actual cases. But let me give you a case that I did. I mean, as the first, one of the very first cold case prosecutions in the state, group of kids, 25, driving down the roads in Anchorage, two separate cars, men in front, women in the back. They would pass each other, and the women would kind of challenge each other, and they were complaining about or arguing about who was, you know, sleeping with who. So the guys driving start cutting each other off. They have a right to be on the road, and they both cars simultaneously pull into a parking lot. Both sides jump out and go towards each other. I mean, looks like good self-defense. It's, you know, they both have a right to be there, and then one kills, you know, the initial aggressor, thinking that, well, not the initial aggressor. I mean, both sides are aggressors. One guy kills another from the other car. You know, now that case settled with a plea, but now we're going to be litigating that case. They had a right to be there. So there's going to be situations like that we anticipate will be going to trial more often. But I mean, in general, the issue is not whether you know, people should have the right to defend themselves or where they should have the right to defend themselves. This is going to create situations where there are going to be what I think people would agree now aren't self-defense, but the door would be open to arguing that they are.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I found that helpful because I had the same initial, which is why, but I think it is going to be, I think that's exactly what's going to happen. There's been a reference made by several people today to the Department of Law's letter from last year. I'm talking about a March 15, 2010 letter, and I have a copy of it, Mr. Chairman. If the members of the committee don't have, I'd be happy to provide it. It's a letter that was written by the Department of Law last year on the similar bill. And
it wasn't this bill, though.
Well, it was not this bill, Mr. Chairman. My understanding, and I'm open to being corrected, is that the letter was written on a prior version of the bill. However, when the bill from the last legislature was amended to look identical to what it is now, we had a discussion on the record, and I think I have copies of the minutes somewhere, where the Department of Law said they still stood by the letter, even as it applied to the prior. I'm happy to provide all of this, because I do acknowledge that it was written on a prior version of the bill. But I think some of the concerns may apply to both the prior version and the current version, Mr. Chairman. So.
Well, to be honest, worth the read. It's four pages. It's mm-hmm. from the Attorney General. Mm-hmm. And if it in any way is helpful to the committee, we should take the time to read it. Not now, of course, but prior to Friday.
Yeah, I would appreciate that, and thank you for having that distributed to the committee, Mr. Chairman. There are a couple of lines in there talking about, if I may read just two or three sentences out of it off the first page.
Go ahead.
It says, every experienced prosecutor with whom I have spoken about this bill uniformly agrees that it would promote violence and be a bad idea for our state. We believe that as drafted, this bill will encourage unnecessary violence in our state. And now I'm dropping down into the second paragraph. It requires that if with complete safety and with complete safety to others being defended, the person can avoid the necessity of using deadly force by leaving the area and the person must do so. Oh, sorry, I got off. I had that highlighted for a different reason. Sorry, the first two sentences were the ones I wanted to read. And,
sure.
And maybe ask Mr. Sabani, well, we have him here, what position the Department of Law takes on the letter that was written in 2010.
Well, we're...
Well, we can have that conversation on Friday if you'd rather, after everyone's reviewed the letter.
Sure. Sooner or later, probably Friday, we'll be voting on this bill. And if someone were to tell me today or Friday that this bill promotes violence, it's my personal belief that this bill will reduce violence. So we have this dichotomy of it depends on who said it, or does it depend on statistics that we can bring in and verify and say, hey, when this letter was written, look at the data that was presented. There's clear indication that it promoted violence. Or without evidence, then it was just a feeling that it could do that, which is not exactly what the committee needs to have in order to vote properly. We want data. We want concrete evidence. And some of us have it in the conversations we've had. We're having testimony from people, and in fact, what I want to do right now is, Lieutenant Dial, are you with us? Lieutenant?
Mr. Chairman, this is Lieutenant Dial with the troop.
Good. Go ahead and help me out a little bit. In your, you know, without data, but in your personal experience, have you seen any connection, because we don't have the bill passed, but in any connection that indicates that we are having more violence or less violence, and have, if we have a person more willing to protect themselves, would we have more violence or less violence?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with the troopers, and I've been with the troopers now for about 20 years, and I've participated in a number of investigations, including homicide investigations. I personally don't see how this legislation will affect the department in one way or another. Anything that is not clearly accidental or natural, as far as the death is concerned, is investigated as if foul play was involved. I don't see how passage of this legislation would dramatically affect the number of cases that we're really seeing for self-defense. You know, if we come across a case, it's clearly a self-defense. In most cases, an arrest will not be made. In those cases where it is questionable, we'll usually contact the district attorney's office first prior to making an arrest. And it's just not something that I've personally seen a lot of over the years. So it's really hard for me to comment on what may happen if this legislation is passed.
Okay. And Mr. Savodny, did you want to add something before we kind of close down for the day and take up our next legislation?
I would, Mr. Chairman. Like Trooper Dial, I don't think you will see an increase in the amount of violence in our society, and I hope that wasn't kind of the impression that I gave in responding to specific questions. I think the number of cases are going to remain the same. It's just how, you know, it just needs to be recalled that it's the state's obligation to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't self-defense if that's the scenario that we're going through. And hopefully, generally, even when the police think it's a self-defense case, they submit that to the DA's office. And, you know, frankly, I don't know of a situation where when the police and the prosecutors were in agreement that the case wasn't screened out.
Okay. With that, is there anyone in the... I'm sorry, do you have a question?
One quick question for Lieutenant Dow.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lieutenant Dow, this is Representative Holmes. We heard from Mr. Sobodny that we're in their fiscal note, they anticipate needing some additional attorneys because more of these cases might be going to trial. Does that put, when cases go to trial, does that put additional burdens on the Department of Public Safety?
Through the Chair, Representative Holmes, the general belief is that the Department does not feel that this legislation would have a significant impact on our activities. If we were to go to trial more as a result of the legislation, yes, it would impact what we were able to do with the current manpower that we have. However, we're just looking at it and looking at the number of cases that we've had over the years and those cases where people have claimed self-defense, the Department of Law is correct. We will pretty much refer everything for review and let the District Attorney's Office determine whether or not prosecution is warranted. So the true effect of this legislation we see is fairly minimal. We just do not believe it's going to cause any fiscal impact for the department.
Okay. Committee members, any more? Anyone in the audience want to testify? This is your chance. And seeing and hearing no one, I want to make an announcement to anybody who's watching these hearings. We did receive 22 letters involving, and all of them were one-directional, and they were not identical letters. They were separate. So we did receive 22 letters of support, none opposed. If you have something you want to email us or you want to call in to testify, expect that Friday will be your last chance. I fully expect we will vote on this legislation on Friday and conclude our work on it. So with that, I'm going to hold this bill until Friday and take a short at ease while we bring up the next one. Judiciary Committee is back on the record. We now have before us House Bill 127, continued from 2 days ago, which is crimes involving minors, stalking, internet issues, etc. And I'm going to ask Doug Moody, are you still on the phone? Doug Moody? Public
yes,
defender?
Mr. Chairman, I am. I'm here.
Now, a couple of days ago, I think you wanted to testify. This is your opportunity if you'd like to add your comments to House Bill 127.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, I wanted to comment on Section 7 of the bill, the section dealing with sending an explicit image of a minor, the sexting provision, if you will. I think that provision as it is currently written is really too broad and will gather in people or scoop in people
that the legislature probably doesn't intend to bring in, like currently as it's written in subsection B, there's an exception for a minor who sends an image of themselves to somebody else. They're not going to be charged. But what it would include is if you have a boyfriend and a girlfriend, and the boyfriend takes a picture with his girlfriend's permission, they're both minors, takes a picture of her breasts, and then sends it to her and her alone, he would be liable under the statute. And from what I gathered before from Ms. Carpinetti's discussion, that what they're really looking for is people that are engaging in wide distribution or sort of furthering the child porn market, that sort of thing, not just the foolish high school kids. The other kind of situation that could arise is where you've got some young people that are sort of engaged in Mardi Gras type behavior where they're all flashing. So, you know, there may be three girls all flashing, fourth girl takes a picture, sends it to one of them, the person who took the picture is now liable, but she sends it to one of the girl sends it to the other girls, and they're all people that were involved, but now, you know, one of the subjects is also liable because she forwarded it to the two other girls. And I don't think those are the kind of people that the legislature is really trying to get here. The other thing is sort of situation that plays off a situation that Representative Holmes was talking about, where you've got a party with like little kids. You know, I bring my 4-year-old to a birthday party where there's another 4-year-old, but that 4-year-old has a 2-year-old sibling that has stripped off and is running around naked in the background. But I'm taking pictures at the party of my 4-year-old because they're doing cute things. Just, you know, not paying any attention or intending to capture images of the 2-year-old running around naked because I really don't care about that 2-year-old. But I send the picture on to my mom, you know, so she can see cute pictures of her grandchild. Now I'm liable. And if I send them by email, I'm liable for a felony. When there was really sort of no ill conduct, I mean, I wasn't trying to take advantage of this 2-year-old or distribute them to pedophiles or anything like that. I'm trying to send a cute picture of my child to my mother. And the internet isn't defined in the statute. And it can be very complicated because you've got high school kids who have got their cameras and they're taking snapping pictures and they're sending them, and some may be sending them by text messages, attachments by text messages. Some will be have phones with data plans, and they're actually using IM so that they don't get charged for texts, for the instant messaging, so they're sort of using thing. And then you got email, and it's all sort of blends because you're all doing this from a phone, and the data is actually going to be traveling over the same fiber optic cables and through the same routing computers. But we call one a text message, you know, that's going, quote, a phone-to-phone contact. But another one, you know, if you can send an email. You send it by email. And what I get concerned about is we have young people or innocent adults, you know, taking pictures of their grandkids, that sort of thing, getting caught up and ending up with convictions that'll be construed as sex convictions down the road when they really weren't, you know, they're not predators. But, you know, if a kid goes out to college know, maybe that state regards it as a registration offense. It's not, maybe not here, but it is there. They go, they may have to list it on their college applications, maybe barriers to getting into the Army. When it's not predatory conduct, and it's not even the sort of the bullying conduct where you take a picture and you just, you know, you have a fight with your girlfriend and you send it out to several people trying to embarrass or harass them, you know, as could be done under the harassment, but it's not, you know, but it isn't sort of the pedophile child porn kind of predatory behavior. And I'm worried the statute as written, I think, will sort of scoop up and allow all these other people to be brought in and charged with this offense, even though they're not the group of people that the legislature's truly or the governor's truly aiming to get.
You know, Doug, it reminds me, we seem to have come full circle when some of the older ones here were children, and we were subjected to harassment and sexually explicit things. We wish we'd had a camera so that we could show mom and dad or anyone else a person who was a social deviant. And now, at the end of the other end of the circle, we have kids who have camera. Everybody's got a camera. It seems every teenager and pre-teenager has a cell phone with camera images, and now we can overdo it. And I don't know that there was a happy medium in between, but in conversations within the committee here and with other people outside the committee, this section is very difficult for us, very difficult. And I wish I could assemble a group of seven teenagers and seven preteens, all who are active cell phone users, and get the input of the significance from them of what they have experienced, what they expect to experience, how harmful something like this can be, how harmful it has been, how harmful it will be. Because as adults, it all looks bad. And to teens, it's, what's the big deal, Mom? Dad? You're overreacting. And how do we know if we're overreacting or if you're just scamming us into buzz off, which is the stuff we do all the time, and as long as you don't know about it, you'll be fine, and we're just going to keep doing it. And the reason we're here is to do a lot more than just say, well, you're right. Go ahead and smoke and drink and have sex and do everything you want, as long as I don't know about it. But we wish we did, and we're able to do something about it. And so that's why we're here. But this section on what to do about this, as Doug Moody has mentioned, is too difficult. Like has been said, I know it when I see it. I know it when I see it. But I cannot write down the rules that makes it illegal without fringing on the other parts of it that are okay. That's the difficulty we're having. So, I don't know. Any of you youngsters on close up in the back, I need one of you to come forward. Some volunteer. Come on forward. And, yeah. And you probably know the way this works. We want to put you on the record, so your name and your affiliation, and you can blame Betty Bear for bringing you here if you want to. And then just your thoughts. They're all on the record. And so I'm not going to caution you against saying or for saying something, but feel free to help us out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is
closer.
Jessica Lucan. I'm with the Juno Close-Up Program. I'm 17, and I'm a junior in high school. I haven't actually looked over the bill, and I've never read it, but just listening through I didn't catch his name. What was his name again? Mr. Moody.
Just public defender.
Mr. Moody's comments. I understand what he's saying about taking a picture and sending it to his mother. Obviously, we do have pictures of babies, and we send them to our grandparents or our brothers and our sisters. And it is innocent in itself because it's a cute picture. But in regards to the other comment about teenagers sending pictures to to other teenagers and other minors. I do have some problems with that, just because it could be sent to an adult, another adult who's friends with the minor, who could pass it on to somebody else. Yeah, it can be passed to so many other people. Mm-hmm. And I also think that maybe part of our society is trying to get rid of those pictures and images on the internet or that are passed through text messages, just to kind of provide a safer environment for our children as well. I've never experienced something like that because I try to stay away from that sort of crowd in itself, because morally I don't agree with what they do. And I think also if we take some of those images off, that'll help other people stand their ground more too, and say this isn't right, we shouldn't be doing that. But that's my own personal belief.
You know, that's exactly what we need, is your personal belief, mm-hmm. rather than relaying someone else's personal belief, because you're a 17-year-old. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in your personal beliefs, what you hold true to your core, what determines maybe how you react and what your future is. So that's why I asked to find a volunteer, and poor you.
No, thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jessica, thank you so much for volunteering. It's, you are very eloquent and very brave for coming in with no advance warning and addressing the committee. What do you think? It sounds like you're struggling with the same thing we are. How do you not get the baby? We know it when we see it. It's clearly not the little baby in their diaper. But how do you write it in words? And then once we figure out how to describe the behavior that we don't want, what do you think it would be an appropriate punishment for somebody who broke that rule?
Once again,
I'm just trying to get, I don't want to put you on the spot too much, but I'm just trying to get a feel from somebody who's sort of in the age group that we're going after. How serious is it if somebody sends a picture like this or puts it on the internet? How serious a thing is that?
I guess if I could just add to that, when that happens, do you say crazy person? Do you say stupid? Do you say needs punishment? Do you say that person needs to have a permanent record? Or where are you in the spectrum of your reaction? I'm not sure, it's up to you to determine the punishment, but your reaction to it is, everybody does it, big deal, or I absolutely hate this with a passion, and those people need terrible punishment. And somewhere inside of those sideboards is your opinion.
And through the chair to Representative Holmes, I think that punishment might be extreme, just because then we're coming into others' personal beliefs, and we do have freedom of speech and choice. But I don't like it when young women aren't as respected as they should be, and they don't respect themselves. So I believe that these text messages and images that are sent through are very disrespecting. They also, I know as a young woman, you struggle with self-confidence, and you know, you don't feel as beautiful as you think you are. So punishment-wise, I'm not exactly sure where I stand, but my own personal opinion, I don't think, I absolutely abhor it.
You abhor it, but you could live with it. You abhor it, but you wish it didn't happen, but I don't have any control. Those are other people. They have their own rights. Is that a position you could take?
Yes, and I believe that society also accepts it. It's something that we've become sort of immune to. You know, gradually, as time's gone on, these images are more accepted in our society, because we think, oh, you know, that's just something that happens. It's okay. You know, it happens every day. But my personal belief is I abhor it, and I don't think it should happen.
You know, all six of us at this table used to be 17. in
not
all
at the same time.
No. I was getting to that. At all different times. And so we can talk to each other and say, you know, when I was 17, here was the major issues I faced. And somehow, in spite of them, we're all sitting around this table as elected officials, and we never would have guessed it. Yeah. So, never even thought about it. You know, where am I going to be in 20, 30, 40, 50 years? Was not on a radar. In fact, I don't know, we had radar back then. But we're here. And we've all had these experiences of most of us, if you added up the number of children that have been raised or are being raised at this table, it's substantial. We all have a vested interest in what's right for children. Arguably, more than any other issue we have is what to do to have children that will grow up in spite of their environment and be productive members of society, proud of themselves, happy with themselves, and able to be creative. We have all these dreams, and yet somebody else out there can do something to absolutely put a knife blade and separate them from their dreams. That's what we're trying to resolve. And it's so hard. So, do you have a comment?
Yep.
Representative Keller.
I just want to say thank you to Jesse for coming up. It has to be terrifying to face the likes of this guy here sitting there. No, exposing yourself to the process. I mean, I'm really proud of you. That's really neat. And you even got it right. You went through the chair. I've forgotten to do that. You know, it was a good job.
Thank you.
Good.
Representative Pruitt, who has, by the way, tell us, you got a birthday party for how old?
Oh, I'll be heading home for my five-year-old on Friday.
So he has a strong interest in watching of his... That's your oldest, isn't it?
That's my oldest, yep.
And only one?
I've got two.
Okay, so you're on the road already worrying about your five-year-old who will be a 17-year-old.
Exactly, and I think as the youngest member on this panel, maybe only by a year...
Wow. Politician.
He's a politician.
You know, even though it wasn't too terribly long ago, this stuff has come up even since I was in high school. We're not here to make sure that kids that are kids will find themselves in a long-term trouble, but it's the malicious intent behind certain things. Mm-hmm. You're there, you're experiencing it, you're in high school, it's happening around you. We're talking about a lot of what ifs. What is your experience? Is there a lot of pictures being taken in your school? Do you hear about or see a lot of pictures that are taken that are done in a malicious way? Are there a lot that are done in just fun? Or, you know, can you, and I know you can't quantify that, five times this happened, five times that happened. But we, as we're talking about this, where we don't want to get certain people in trouble because they didn't have a malicious intent, I guess it's probably good to understand, is that taking place in the high schools or around where you are?
To the chair, to Representative Pruitt, for the record, I do have to say that I'm homeschooled. So, and I've never been to a real school. So I've been in a maybe more sheltered environment, and I appreciate the way that my parents have raised me as well, as because they've introduced me gradually, and I believe that I have different morals and standards than some teenagers my age. I'd also like to say that I am still trying to form my own opinion on this piece of legislation. There are some issues that I haven't completely decided where I stand, just as all of you. So I couldn't tell you specifically. I've never received a text or an email because I try to choose the friends and people that I associate are who I would like to grow and as a person as well, who reflects the same morals and values as I have.
You on Facebook?
Yes, sir.
Twitter?
No, sir.
But you're on Facebook. Yes, and you have your profile on Facebook?
Mm-hmm.
Do you get friend requests on Facebook from people you've never heard of in your life?
Not recently, actually. I just got my Facebook this year. I do have my own personal policy not to accept friend requests from people that I don't know. Even if they're friends of friends, I'm still very iffy on whether to be friends with them or not because I've never met them before. It also kind of depends on the situation and how close of friends they are with one of my good friends as well. So.
Okay.
Very good.
I'll just follow up.
Representative Pruitt.
I congratulate you on your first time in the hot seat here.
Is it your first time?
Yeah, you're doing a very good job for first time up there, isn't you? And also for, as a young lady, standing strong for what you believe in. I commend you on that.
Thank you.
And I've raised four children. I don't know if it's difficult. You just work at it, and you produce kids that all go to graduate school and get married and have their own children, and as a parent, you feel like, gosh, that is a successful parent, to have produced a productive member of society. The trouble we have is our environment is trying to stop us from being successful, and we're here to defeat that. And it's hard to do. It's hard to do. Because we don't know, like anything else, how many law books do we have? They're full of laws. Why can't there be one law? Don't do anything stupid. Because nobody knows exactly what that means. So let me take a moment at this time. Don't leave the seat. Do we have another student that wants to come up here? Willing to come up here? Oh, good. Come on up. This is known as the barrel. We're putting you in the barrel. and you'll need to state your name and, again, your affiliation. And put that microphone where it's closer to your mouth.
I'm Tiffany Boineau. I'm 15. I'm also a student through IDEA Homeschooling. I am currently here on the Juneau, Alaska close-up trip. And I have a Facebook, and there through the contact information, it can ask for an email in case you forget your password or if you want others to be able to find you. And I filled it out, and I received, for lack of a better word, graphic links, and it would be nice to be able to go through my email without having to worry about what I'm going to see.
What did you do with them?
Delete
them?
Yeah, I delete them.
Or respond and say, don't send me these?
I usually delete them because I assume that my email will just encourage the site to continue to contact me.
Some people will send you things that make you respond to them so they can get a list of people who are willing to respond.
Precisely.
And you just put yourself right in the group as soon as you respond. It's you delete them a few times, then they tend to stop being they stop coming, basically. So you've actually, for 15-year-old, you're right on task for making mistakes. Gosh, you're supposed to make mistakes. You'll never learn if you don't. It's like going skiing. If you never fall, you're not learning. if you're going to go play any other sport, if you don't take a chance, you'll never succeed at the high levels. So congratulations to you, too. So you have gotten emails.
Yes.
And you didn't like them, and they were too graphic.
Yes.
And were they... You didn't know who they were from either.
No, I did not recognize the email, and it didn't provide contact information.
And was it male, female, or both?
Both. Some of them were accompanied with links. And it, personally, I was quite disturbed that I would be receiving this information.
Did you tell your parents?
Yes. I've told them a couple of times, but otherwise I just tend to delete them.
So is this on your computer or your cell phone?
My computer.
You have a cell phone?
I do.
Do you text?
On occasion.
While you're driving?
Oh, you're 15.
You're only 15. You
can't. That's another bill. That's another bill.
Might be entrapment, Mr. Chair.
It actually was intended to be that. We do have, you know, we have plenty of bills that come before us. Even the first one today, you remember that one, the self-defense bill?
Yes.
That's a big deal. There's a lot of complicated parts to that, and that's what our job is to deal with it. There's way more complicated parts to this one. This is a two-week bill, in my opinion. We will be on this one and stay on it until when we release it. It's not perfect, but it's as good as we can make it. And what really helps is interviews with people that testify. Now, if I keep getting old people to testify, I can almost predict what what their opinions will be. But I cannot predict what 15 and 17-year-old opinions will be, because I don't have any left. I mean, my youngest is 21, and that's a long way from 17. Enormous change between 17 and 21. They actually become more adult. Honest to Pete. I start looking at my 21-year-old and go, he's smarter than I am in some ways. Not many, but some. I wanted to, and thank you so much for your willingness to put yourself on the record. You know, this will be televised, and we'll go on gavel to gavel, I don't know how many times, and you'll be able to listen to yourself. What did I say? I was scratching my head, or I was adjusting my glasses, or why did I say that? But it's all been pretty helpful. I think the public that sees it will probably say that it was a good opportunity for the public to hear what you had to say, and certainly for the committee to hear what you had to say. So the only person left now is Mrs. Bear. I won't do that. Thank you so much for your time. We still have a few minutes. Is there anything you wanted to add that wasn't a question, but some comments that you feel are worthwhile making, and you can address them to us to say, you know, what you ought to be thinking about is, and then you fill out the rest. What would that be? Okay, first name?
Jessica Lucan, and I'm with the Juno Club.
That helps our recording secretary when she says who's speaking.
I'd like to thank you for this opportunity. It's been a good experience. And most of my reason for coming up here was just to remind you of that there are young teenagers out there who don't agree with sending graphic images. I'd also like to point out, I believe I don't have this as a solid fact, but I believe that the younger you are that you see a graphic image like that, the harder it will be to break away from something, break that habit as well. So if this is being distributed to preteens as well as young as 10 or 11 who are in middle school, I'd just like you to think and reflect on that as well.
I'm going to ask you, go ahead, you have a comment too? Go ahead. No, go ahead. First name?
Tiffany.
Go ahead.
I also want to thank you for allowing me to come up here. I really do appreciate being able to speak to all of you today. This is something I care about, and it has not just affected me, but I have a 12-year-old cousin as well, and he's received these types of emails, and he took my advice and deleted them. But the fact that he has to confront that on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, it's disturbing.
Okay. Tough question for both of you. What is worse for teenagers, drugs or alcohol?
Drugs.
Because of the variety or because of the long term? I mean, we've heard that drinking is pretty rampant. It's easy to go into your house, your own house, and find alcohol and drink a little. And your parents who own the alcohol might have a whole skew of bottles and not notice any part that's missing. You can also go into the medicine chest, take some pills. Prescription drugs is an easy way to essentially get high. We have to deal with a bill coming up soon on synthetic cannabinoids. What does that mean?
Basically, fake marijuana.
Good for you. You knew that too. You know the name of any one of them?
Not quite sure.
Okay, do you? Good. That means you're probably not exposed to them. But when synthetic marijuana comes on the market, it's legal. Here we go through all the trouble of naming all the kinds of things you smoke illegal, and we had pages of them, and now we've got two more pages, if not three, of synthetic forms of the same thing. It's a tough job that we do. But I want to remind you that a big part of our job is protecting you, even though you probably don't see it a lot. All these laws are out there. A lot of them are for protecting our children. And I think everybody here counts you two as our children, because you're part of the larger group of kids. You're representative of children, probably at the high end, be my guess, that you're able to speak in front of a bunch of old people, except for her and him. Sorry. And so I think that probably concludes our work for today. Like I said, I've already kind of asked you for some final thoughts, but you don't think alcohol is a, or you don't think it's a bad deal, or it's just not as bad as drugs?
I believe they are equally, for lack of a better word, terrible. Mm-hmm. But I go with saying that drugs are worse because they are very easily accessible, from my experience within the valley, and whereas alcohol, your parents are more likely to notice than with drugs that you buy from a friend or on the street.
Yeah.
And they could be easily more addictive.
Did you go to the exhibit today on the second floor in the Butrovich room?
No, I did not.
It was like an art exhibit. It had a dozen people's faces, and all of them told about their alcohol addiction. And drugs, how devastating it was for their lives and their advice. The pictures look like everybody normal, and yet they were the same people that had destroyed their lives. They will tell you, I destroyed my life. And what did it take? It took, oh, I think I'll fix something with alcohol or drugs. And I have been on the offense for methamphetamine. How to reduce demand. Cannot figure out how to reduce the supply, but I'm trying to, the heck with the supply, it's always going to be there, but the demand, and that's kind of a focus that I'm on right now to deal with that, and I found several ways that do it, but once again, I asked kids, how easy are drugs to get in high school? And my kids look at me like I'm stupid. Dad, anybody can get anything they want anytime. And I said, that bad? I said, oh yeah, that bad. What's the difference between this school and that school? Well, in this school, it's a higher end school, so they're more expensive. That's the difference. But our schools are riddled with drug availability. And we don't see it until we see the effect it has. So with that, I'm going to conclude our hearing. Any more questions, thoughts, comments? With that, just sure.